from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. 153 years ago today, the United States ratified the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery. And we're marking the occasion on Forum by talking about the Bay Area and California, rich but often overlooked African-American history. Joining us to help us uncover these stories are John William Templeton. He's here with us in studio. He's a historian and creator of the California African-American Freedom Trail, author of The Road to Ratification, Our Roots Run Deep, Come to the Water, and Citizenship for All. And good to have you with us. Welcome.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
We also welcome Taylor Bythewood Porter, who's Assistant Curator of History at the California African-American Museum, curated the exhibition California Bound, Slavery and the New Frontier, 1848 to 1865. And we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you.
Glad to have you both. And John William Templeton, I'm going to begin with you. And I was actually just reading, and I think it was in the Examiner, an article about you talking about the origins even of the name California from Queen Khalifa, and mentioning an old friend of mine, Ray Taliaferro, who just passed away. And I want to just give honor to Ray and his memory, because he was really a former president of the NAACP and quite a remarkable talk show host, to put it mildly, in the old days when he was a colleague of mine. I wanted to ask you, though, about this trail, this Freedom Trail. And there are a lot of plaques there, and there's a lot of identity for locals that they can find out and connect the dots to African-American history. So talk about it.
Well, actually, it's a statewide project to show the ongoing and continuous role of the Golden State in the end of slavery, in the development of music and culture, in the birth of the labor movement, in the end of Jim Crow, in the integration of professional sports, and most recently, the end of apartheid. And so there's a multilingual and a multinational aspect to it that is beyond most people's realization. So what we've had to do over the last 25 years since I did Our Roots Run Deep is actually do tours and actually show people.
And educate them. And
because,
there's a lot to be educated about.
Otherwise,
here,
they wouldn't believe it. And so so Ray was the catalyst for me writing Our Roots Run Deep, because I had been in L.A. covering the Rodney King beating. And while I was down there, I found out that the Pico brothers owned the San Fernando Valley and that they had been the last two governors of out to California. So I came back and was on his show, just like I am to now, and said, you know, there were four black governors of out to California, and he responds, well, the whole damn state's named after a black woman.
Yeah, well, he always talked about God as a black woman. I don't know if you remember that, but Ray was a firebrand. He was a firebrand of the left, and off the air, he was one of the sweetest and most humble and gentlemanly men that I've had the great privilege of knowing.
Well, let me tell you one other thing about Ray. He was the piano prodigy, and he was the music director at Third Baptist Church during the 50s. And so whenever Martin Luther King came to town, Ray Taliaferro was his music director. So so that's an aspect of his history that most people don't know. He was also the spokesman for the auto road demonstrations on Van Ness Avenue and desegregated the auto industry nationally. So most people would call it, you know, call it a good life at that point, but he was just in his 20s then.
I'm glad you mentioned Martin Luther King in this context. Let's talk about San Francisco, because Martin Luther King, again, a lot of people don't know this, would come to San Francisco every summer as a kid. And you talk about the figures that really were in many ways larger than life that are associated with San Francisco. I mean, there's a connection to Langston Hughes in San Francisco. There's a connection to W.E.B. Du Bois, to Wallace Thurman. I mean, the list goes on. Even, and I'd like to focus on this for a moment, to Ellen Pleasant, who had a lot to do with John Brown and Harper's Ferry.
Well, you know, part of why California, the battle for California, was actually the most important battle of the Civil War, was that the state was dominated by Southern sympathizers throughout the 1850s. And so it was in their desire to be part of the Confederacy. And so Lincoln actually sent his law partner, Edward Baker, out here to keep California in the Union, and Thomas Starr King came out. But a big part of that effort were the three African-American churches that still are here today that were founded in 1852. So a big part of the role of the Gold Rush abolitionists was to keep California in the Union and also to make sure that slavery didn't spread to California. And so Mary Ellen Pleasant, who was the financier behind it, she actually went to Ontario and took $30,000 to fund John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, which most historians think is the precipitating event for the Civil War. So they weren't just resisting. They were actually catalysts for ending slavery. And the annual report of Third Baptist Church in 1858 said that our sole purpose is the elimination of American chattel slavery. So they were very focused on that. And those campaigns have basically continued to this day.
John William Templeton here in studio is a historian and creator of the California African American Freedom Trail. And it's a good time to bring in Taylor Bythewood Porter, who's assistant curator of history of the California African American Museum and curated exhibition called California Bound, which is all about slavery on the new frontier between 1848 and 1865. And Ms. Bythewood Porter, California's role is much more important here than most people realize. Let's talk about it with you.
Yeah, absolutely. With this particular exhibition and the research that we did regarding it and working with various scholars throughout the state, we definitely come to find out that with the discovery of gold in the Sutter's Mill in 1848 really started this great migration and influx of people into California as a federal territory at this point. It was after the Mexican-American War. And so now, with all these people coming into California, you know, people from northern the United States and the southern United States, and even from across the world, they're all coming into California and all seeking for, you know, gold, money, and opportunity. And like you guys were speaking of, then also we're having political parties also coming to California to try to see what they can do and how can California be positioned. But what we found is, you know, with the Missouri Compromise of 1820, the United States really wanted to keep an equal balance between free states and slave states in order to maintain this balance and peace within the United States. However, with California coming into, you know, becoming a federal territory and wanting statehood, it would upset the balance. And so there we see the Compromise of 1850, which granted California entering into the Union as a free state. But it also saw a stricter Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which affected the nation.
Well, California had its own Fugitive Slave Act, didn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They definitely did, which a lot of people don't know. It started in 1852 as a result of the Federal Act. One of the stipulations with the Federal Act that we come to find is that one had to actually cross state lines in order to really become a fugitive. And so with California being so distant from, you know, the states and the South, nobody is really running away from Mississippi all the way to California and vice versa. And so the Democrats at the time who, you know, were pretty much the ruling power in California. And again, the political parties are vastly different in this time period than they are now. The Democrats then were more pro-enslavement. And it wasn't just a two-party system. There were multiple layers. But
excuse me, I'm just thinking about the fact that the first governor of California, Peter Burnett, really tried to bring, he was very pro-slavery, he tried to bring slavery to California, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He definitely did. And as the first governor of California, he even enacted this suppression where minorities would not be able to speak out in court against white males.
It's remarkable to think about.
So limiting testimony. Yeah, it was a and, you know, you're thinking about how California government was formed and who these political figures and how they were involved in shaping and crafting California legislation. It really left minority communities of, you know, indigenous people, Mexican-Americans, African-Americans, even Chinese-Americans, and definitely women at a disadvantage.
We're talking a good deal here about black history in California, how it affected slavery, the lead up to the Civil War, but also looking at, well, the roots of not only black history that we see still throughout the state of California, and certainly the Freedom Trail really gives us a broad and very specific notion of, I mean, talking about, for example, a major figure like Maya Angelou, you know, who had the first cable car here in San Francisco. And even up to the present day, when you think about the African-American mayor, woman of the city of San Francisco, I'd like to hear from you, our listeners, some thoughts you might have and some questions you might have for our two historians, well, actually, curator of history at the California African American Museum, Taylor Bythewood Porter with us, and John Williamson Temple, who is a historian and creator of the California African American Freedom Trail. Some thoughts, some questions. We do want to hear from you, and maybe a question about why it's important to reclaim history. What about, in your mind, the significance of going back and looking at these places where African Americans had a presence and looking back at the history of the 13th Amendment and what it means today? And we'd like to hear from you now. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. So please feel free to join the program. Again, the number for your calls, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment and post any questions or comments you might have there, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And more of a little bit of local black history here, if I could, with you, John William Templeton. I mean, let's talk about, for example, the fact that the Fillmore was once, as many people know, old timers, especially in San Francisco, really a black community.
It still is. I live there, so at least Yeah.
But vestiges of what it was, I mean, in terms of being really a center, an epicenter of black life. I mean, the population of African-Americans has gone down. It's headed down. It's down to 3%.
One thing I'd like to dismiss is the whole notion of Harlem of the West. Smithsonian did an exhibit a couple weeks ago about Harlem of the West in Denver. And so, you know, people use it in San Diego and a bunch of other places. And so it was basically, you know, lazy journalists who, you know, just called every black community Harlem. But when you look at the actual primary sources, it would actually be more accurate to call Harlem the Western edition of the East.
Because... Can I quote John Weldon Johnson? You know what he called Harlem? Black Manhattan.
Yeah. And so Burt Williams, who was the most famous most famous person in America in 1900, his house is at the corner of Golden Gate and Divisadero, right around the corner from mine. He moved there in 1895. And so when he moved to New York and became the first African-American to do a recording, and then in 1903 became the first to be on Broadway, he was the first black person moved to Harlem. So you actually had the movement from San Francisco to New York. Also, Clarence Williams Sr., who is the grandfather of Clarence Williams III. I'm sure you're old enough to remember.
Mod Squad.
Mod Squad, right? Yeah. Well, he was part of the first jazz band in history that played at Purcell's at 550 Pacific. And he moved back to New York and became one of the first jazz musicians in New York. So one of the mistakes that's made in history is that people are quick to jump on a particular theme without actually looking behind it to the primary sources. And what we've done in researching the 6,000 sites of the California African American Freedom Trail is really looked at the primary source data, but also importantly looked at history through the eyes of the people who are participating in it. And so many of our mistakes get made because somebody says something and then other people come along and repeat it without actually going to. And what we found not only in California, but as we did the research on Citizenship for All and Road to Ratification, is that African-American writers of the 17th and 18th and 19th century were not only very prolific, but they were also very scholarly. So the detail that they gave in their descriptions of what was happening, it's probably the most scientific research that was done at the time. People like George Washington Williams and W.E.B. Du Bois, that sort of thing. I mean, just voluminous works with great detail. And also it's amazing the amount of information that they had about Africa and how much they were connected to Africa and their global viewpoint.
Well, Du Bois wound up leading a Pan-African movement, moved to Africa.
Yeah, this will be the 100th anniversary of it next year. Yeah. So we can rely on those materials to have the kind of detail that allows us to begin to connect the dots and see the agency that African Americans had. I mean, you know, by the end of 1863, the Loyal League had 700,000 members and 4,500 chapters. This was six months after, you know, the end of, you know, the Emancipation Proclamation. So there was a high degree of organization in the African American community that hasn't been passed on through traditional
accounts. That's the importance of history right there. You just nailed it. I mean, passing it on and making the awareness, as you say, going back to the roots, the sources, and connecting those dots. And that's why it's important, I think, to have a conversation like this. I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad that Taylor Bythewood Porter is with us. And I want to bring our listeners with us as well. Let me find out what's on their minds. We begin, Lisa, with you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Sorry, I'm joining the show a little bit late, but I've been listening to this, and I'm writing a book right now, a juvenile fiction series about Queen Calafia, who is from the chivalric romance Las Cercas Esplendian. And I'm sort of wondering, since she's sort of the mythological origin of California, and she was black in the book and non-Christian and controlled an army of female warriors that rode around on griffins patrolling the borders, why isn't she taught in schools? And why don't we know in public schools anything about her? And how does she feature into the sort of colonial imagination of California as well?
So no, thank you question. For that question. We're back to Queen Calafia. John, you want to...
Well, actually, in our Roots Run Deep, we actually explore that issue in three different chapters. And when we do professional development with teachers, we actually use that question to actually go back to the whole origin of race, because there was a genre of literature that was inspired by the voyage of Mansa Musa to Mecca in the 1300s, where black women warriors were the exemplars for wealth and beauty. And so this is one of many stories that are similar. And so,
isn't it assumed the name California comes from her, though? Isn't it?
Yeah. It comes from Khalifa, which was the term that was given to Mansa Musa on his voyage to Mecca. So, California was in the Las Cercas de Esplandian, an island nation where only black women lived, and pearls were as numerous as rocks, and gold was the only metal. So, in my book, I was able to show that Cortez actually read the book. And in 1524, asked the crown for permission to go find the Isle of California, which is supposed to be on the right hand of the Indies next to the terrestrial paradise. And so when they landed on what's now Baja California, 1535, that's how it got the name. And for the next 150 years, California was shown as an island. So it wasn't until the mid-1700s that they actually found out it was connected to the rest of Northern America. So
let me get to some more calls, but before I do, let me bring you back into this, Taylor Bythewood Porter. Civil War, I want to get back to the 13th Amendment, because that's what we're thinking in terms of 153 years today. It was ratified but here in California, but the 14th and 15th were not. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, kind of going back a little bit with the 13th Amendment, we originally kind of see that verbiage show up in the California Constitution, which for us at the California African American Museum, we found it very fascinating that within the California Constitution, which was first put forth in 1849, featured that same verbiage, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, unless for the punishment of a crime, shall ever be tolerated in this state. And then we see it again at the 13th Amendment, which granted freedom to over, you know, 3.9 million enslaved Africans in in the country. And, you know, it was supposed to be ratified by all of the states. But what we also found that was interesting was in 1868, when the 14th Amendment was proposed, and in 1870, when the 15th Amendment was proposed, which both granted citizenship for all and equal voting rights, California didn't ratify those, the 14th Amendment until 1959, and then the 15th Amendment until 1962, which we found was very interesting. We feel that, you know, based off of our research, California kind of switched gears and rather, you know, really focused on Chinese immigrants coming into California and not being able to grant full citizenship and voting rights kind of helped limit, you know, in their eyes, these the Democrats who were coming back to California after the Civil War to be able to limit these rights for these minority communities.
So there's again, much more focus on the Chinese and the xenophobia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we can see how it leads into the Chinese Exclusion Act.
Yeah. Let me lead into some more calls here, and let me go next to Sonoma and welcome Paul. Paul, join us.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I find this conversation fascinating, and it reminds me of when I first moved to San Francisco about 7 months ago and started working at Leidesdorf Place.
It's Leidesdorf.
Leidesdorf, excuse me. And, you know, I just find his history fascinating. I think he should be celebrated more as a founding father of San Francisco, and obviously one of the first dignitaries, served as a consul to Mexico, donated the land for the first public school in San Francisco, brought the first steamship into San Francisco Bay, the Sitka, and died under somewhat mysterious circumstances, as I understand. And I just hope you might be able to give a little more detail than just what I've been able to find so far of this person.
Well, you gave us a nice encapsulation. Yeah,
yeah, you're actually reading from the inscription that I wrote for the statue at Leidesdorf and Pine, and we've been working with Clint Rowley on boosting that history. One of the markers for the Freedom Trail is going to go there at Leidesdorf Street. The big thing to remember about Leidesdorf is that he paid for the Mexican War. He actually took out a loan for $50,000 and paid for the provisions for the U.S. Army and Navy during the Mexican War. So just imagine that.
What was his stake or interest in that?
Well, he was the sub-counsel. And so there was a essentially a dispute between the Pico brothers, who were the richest people in Southern California, and Leidesdorf, who was the richest man in Northern California. All three of them are black. About who was going to be in charge. So the Pico brothers wanted to stay a part of Mexico, and Leidesdorf wanted to become part of the United States. And so Leidesdorf worked with John Larkin, and he wrote the report on the Bear Flag Revolt. John Fremont stayed at Leidesdorf's house. And probably one of his most enduring legacies is his mentorship of John Fremont, who went on to become the first Republican presidential candidate. So Leidesdorf is somebody who's very important, but we're using him for a campaign every April 3rd, which is the dedication of the first public school, to get kids to reduce chronic absenteeism. Because in many cases, students feel like school isn't for them. And when we point out, well, the first public school in California was built by a black man who was a math genius and spoke six languages, it's a way to grab kids' attention and address the 13% proficiency for math and language, you know, among students. So we are working very, very hard on getting his story out among our school children.
Let me thank you, Paul, for that call and bringing up Leidesdorf. Let me get another call around, and that's Kevin. Kevin, join us.
Yeah, hi. I found some old letters from that my great-great-grandmother dictated to my grandmother describing their migration to the Owens Valley and about being involved in some Indian wars. And she describes an African-American who is traveling with them in a wagon train across the country and landing in, somewhere in the Owens Valley. I'm wondering how many African-Americans settled in the Owens Valley, if you know if there was much of a presence in the 1850s and 60s?
John, you know?
Well, in the course of our four-volume book, we have African-Americans among the earliest settlers of every part of California. Keep in mind that 40% of the pobladores under Mexican and Spanish rule were of African descent. So, you know, with 2 million acres of land grants that were controlled by African Americans. So the more you look at any part of California, you're going to find African Americans, you know, among the earliest residents. So it's important to actually go to those sources of family records and churches. We've got 20 black churches in the state that predate the Civil War, so we can find them anywhere.
Let me thank Kevin. Go to another caller. Mark, that's you. Thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hello?
Yeah, Mark, you're on the air.
Yes, very quickly, two little-known historical facts. My hometown in Texas, which coincidentally is also Cecil Williams' hometown, has a plaque on the courthouse lawn commemorating the county's namesake, Tom Green, who was a Confederate major general. He led an expeditionary force toward California with the intent of seeing if they could stir up some pro-Confederate sentiment here. And he was intercepted accidentally by a federal force in Arizona, sent him scurrying back to Texas. The other is, I was amazed to learn this recently, the last state to end slavery, believe it or not, was New Mexico in 1867.
Yeah.
I guess because it was still a territory at the time, maybe the 13th Amendment didn't apply, but there was a colony using slave labor in eastern New Mexico, and the slaves there were all Native Americans.
Well, I thank you for that fact, Mark. We're going to have to wrap here, but I appreciate hearing from you and from hearing other listeners asking about books to read on the history of African Americans in California. I would recommend John William Templeton's work. And can they, Taylor Bythewood Porter, can they see what you've curated on YouTube, or is it available online?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We did a curatorial walkthrough not too long ago, and it was filmed, and people can view that on Facebook. And they can even come to the museum if they're in Los Angeles. We're at 600 State Drive in Exposition Park, so right across from USC, and the exhibition will be open until April 28th.
Well, we appreciate your being with us, and John William Templeton, appreciate you.
Sure. You can get those books at queencalifiamovie.com.
There you go. And there we go, because we have wrapped up this hour. I want to just put a pitch in for African-American writers. Not only are these figures so important in California history, but it's important to remember that African-American literature is very much a part of American literature. Go back to Jupiter Hammond and Phyllis Wheatley and Angelina Grimke and Charles Chestnut, and I could go on, but I won't. Also, the Harlem Renaissance. I'll leave it there. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.